And casting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. This podcast is a little different. First of all, we're going to talk about the feature film Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is a large visual effects movie with lots of different vendors. Also, it's unusual because Mike, John, and I are all in the same room in Los Angeles doing this podcast, having just completed a training session at the Autodesk facility in Venice, California, for their open house. It was very successful. We had a great time doing it, and it's unusual for us to get together more than once a year for NAB usually. Anyway, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Mike, you got to talk to multiple people this time.
Absolutely, Jeff. As you know, one of the most beloved feature films of a children's novel was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, directed by Tim Burton, starring Johnny Depp. Actually, there were three major effects houses involved in it, all from London: MPC, Frameworks, and CineSite. And all of them spoke to us for this special podcast. What we've done, actually, is start with Chaz Jarrett, who breaks down the film overall for us. And he was actually on a different movie set when he spoke to us on the phone earlier today. And then we're going to break down one of the shots, which is the nut room sequence, and have a look at that in a whole lot of depth with a couple of the guys from Frameworks. In addition to that, on the website is a bunch of background stuff and a lot of really great exclusive before and after shots explaining how the guys did things. But, yeah, it's a good piece.
Great, let's listen.
So thanks for joining us today. You've obviously been working at MPC on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Can you tell me what your role was on the film?
Yeah, I was the visual effects supervisor. So I worked through the pre-production period, planning and previs, and then moved and supervised the shoot itself with Nick Davis, who was the main visual effects supervisor for Warner Brothers. And then I also came back to MPC and supervised the post-production there.
So as I understand it, there was about 300 shots initially, and it grew to about 800 by the end, of which MPC did the majority?
That's right, yeah. I think MPC ended up doing about 550. But yeah, I mean, through unforeseen circumstances, as is usual, the general shot count for the movie grew quite substantially, and we absorbed a lot of that growth.
And the film's magnificent. I saw it recently. It doesn't open here for a while, but
thank you.
It's great work. I was wondering if I could just hit on, firstly, the Oompa Loompas, because the replication of one actor, or in fact the crowd creation of one from one person, was pretty extraordinary.
Sure, yeah.
You had a variety of techniques that you'd deployed there to solve problems, right?
Very much so. Yeah, we began thinking that that we'd basically replicate Deep Roy, not so much replicate, but shoot motion control, and position him in different parts of the set and shoot motion control moves. And slowly build up shots that way, where we could have maybe 20 or 30 Oompa Loompas performing together, basically in sync with each other. And that then led on in some other situations where that wasn't practical to animatronics, which Tim Burton wanted to use very heavily, partly just because he really prefers live action and practical effects to CG. So, I mean, initially, we were trying to keep the CG work on the Oompa Loompas to an absolute minimum. And then, motion control is a complex thing to wrangle, and we shot on the chocolate room stage for, I think, about 10 weeks or so, maybe 8 weeks. And that's a very long, slow process to just be shooting these repeat moves endlessly time and time again. And Deep Roy had to perform in sync to audio playback that was then synced to the motion control unit. And we often find we were doing 10 takes or 12 takes possibly of each position, and then if we had 50 positions we had to shoot them in, obviously the number of takes went up hugely, and it became just a very long, drawn out experience. And I mean, the results were fantastic, and it was really working for everybody, but we also began then to really explore the CG option of doing digital Oompa Loompas, simply as a time saving ultimately. So for some of the other sequences, I mean, the chocolate room sequence was very heavily live action, and specifically he was shot on the set. He was shot on an overscale portion of the chocolate room set.
Now, this was different from the main set, that because I understand the main set, they didn't really want to mount cameras and stuff on the set. They were trying to fly most of the things in from the side or above.
No, Well, I mean, there were a whole bunch of sets. Obviously, the chocolate room was a major set. Then there was the television room, the inventing room, and what was the other? The nut room, there you go.
Did you have a scaled version of the chocolate room, of the main?
No, the sets were all built as practical sets. The chocolate room was built on the biggest stage in Europe, the 007 stage at Pinewoods, which is enormous. So that was built as an entirely practical construct. The only thing missing was the top half of it. But the entire floor plan, as it were, was all there. The chocolate river was really there. It was all real. So our work in that room was extending the set vertically upwards and extending the chocolate waterfall upwards and adding a roof and all of those things. But the actual set itself was all there. So on that set, we shot everything in situ on the set. And Deep Roy, who obviously is only 4'2" as it is, we built some of the sets 1.73 times too big, so slightly overscale, dressed it with large plants, large grass, all those types of elements, and then filmed him completely in situ under the normal lighting on that stage. And that's how that sequence was done.
And so,
I don't think we actually did... Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, and so you mentioned before you also did, you know, a computerized version of his performances, which I understand you motion captured, and then you had, was it Alice crowd control software that you wrote?
Yeah, well, we have a crowd system called Alice that we developed for Troy a couple of years ago, and we've used on pretty much all the films we've done ever since in some way or another. It's quite flexible software. So, I mean, we always knew we were going to be doing some digital Oompa Loompas, so we were building and you know, running cloth sims and hair sims and facial capture and all of that stuff from quite an early stage. I think what became clear as we were shooting was we were going to have to do more and more CG Oompas. So we really worked on our pipeline for those Oompas. And there was also, of course, the blue screen side of the Oompa Loompas, which was we went to a blue screen stage and shot motion control on blue screen, which is a bit more controllable than shooting on a beauty set. But obviously, you know, there are issues to do with integrating blue screen characters into a live action set that are complex to achieve. And again, the digital Oompa Loompas were simply simpler from virtually every perspective, in that we could light them as we saw fit. And tracking them into live action plates was, in some cases, simpler than shooting blue screen motion control and tracking that into live action plates. Those were the three main techniques. The three main techniques were, you know, on set motion control, blue screen motion control, or CG.
And the there was cloth simulation on the digital Oompa Loompas, which used Cyflex. Is that right?
We did. We used the Cyflex plugin. To Maya, which with very, very little customization or anything, it pretty much works out of the box. It's a very robust simulation system, and particularly with the Oompas wearing a single-piece costume, which was made of a kind of plastic in reality, is quite complex because, obviously, being a single-piece costume, if you move any part of your body, like your shoulder or something, it does have an effect on every other piece of the costume, so the ankle would move if you moved your arm or something. So having a constrained cloth costume in that way is quite a complex thing for any solver to handle, but it did a very good job of it.
Can I ask you about your pipeline? Were you you did the Maya you mentioned already, but what was the OpenEXR pipeline? I mean, what's the was it composited in Shake? What was the?
It is, yeah. Well, basically, we use Maya as our primary 3D front end with PRMan, RenderMan as our rendering, and Shake for comping. But we have a whole load of customizations. We did ship over to the OpenEXR format for Troy. It was the first show I think we used it on. And now the whole facility runs under floating point linear color space.
And you mentioned there that you went to RenderMan. On the other stuff that you did, like the tunnel ride, I read somewhere that you used something called Puddle between the CGI fluid simulations and RenderMan. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, Puddle is kind of a suite of tools. I mean, the basic gist is simply it's a way of taking kind of arbitrary displacements and arbitrary attributes, I suppose, and kind of plugging them all together at render time to produce, in our case, a chocolate river. So, for example, we had an animated, quite complicated animated displacement shader, which created the basic flowing look of the river. But then all of the other interactions, for example, we had real flow simulations of splashes of chocolate. Those were blended into the main surface using Puddle. And we also wrote some geometry deformers geometry displacement that connected in through Puddle. And the geometry displacements effectively allow you to model a piece of geometry in the shape that you want. And at render time, that geometry basically gets converted into displacements on another surface. So you can have an animated piece of geometry animating the way you want, floating quite nearby another surface, and at render time it'll blend the two things together, but as displacements. And what Puddle really allowed us to do was to come up with a whole bunch of different ways of creating ripple effects and splashes and whatever, you know, fluidy effects we wanted, and Puddle would basically blend them all together at render time.
And what about the gimbal? It looked like an enormous rig that you mounted the real live version for the actors to sit on, shot against green screen.
Yeah, that was good fun. That was the boat basically was in a giant green screen stage at Pinewood. It was about 25-foot-high gimbal rig that's a hydraulic. It was a full-size boat was mounted on it that all the principal actors could sit on and be filmed from any angle. And the rig would rotate 360 degrees. It could lean and pitch and yaw and roll and all those things. And all the close-ups for the river ride sequences were shot on that rig.
How critical was previs on that stuff? Did you previs everything, or was it limited use?
It varied from sequence to sequence with the previs, to be honest. The songs themselves, of which there are four, were very highly previs right down to the frame, because the live-action elements were all shot with motion control. So the previs actually created the camera moves that eventually were fed into the MoCo unit. To acquire the elements. For the river ride sequence, the White Tunnel ride, it was much more freeform, really. I mean, it was a guide for Tim to shoot to, but the camera wasn't computer-controlled, the gimbal rig wasn't computer-controlled in the sense that Previs was driving it or anything like that. It was hand-controlled with joysticks. So the Previs was on set, really, for Tim Burton to review and look at and get the screen direction right for where, you know, which way the boat was facing on this shot or that shot or what have you. But there was also a lot of dialogue in that sequence, and Tim wanted to be free to shoot that dialogue as he saw fit. So we just simply made sure we had a lot of tracking markers around and let him film for the 3 days or so it took to shoot that. And then we took that, it went to editorial, and the sequence was really created after it was shot, primarily. I think, there were some big CG shots in the White Tunnel ride that didn't change from previs to final, but there were a lot of in-between sequences, particularly relating to dialogue, that changed after the shoot and after the cut was done.
Look, I know you're tight for time, and I thank you for spending some time with us and working through that. It's great work, and thank you very much.
Hey, you're more than welcome. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Mike. That was really interesting. It was really great of Chaz, too, for him to take time out of his schedule to talk to us.
Yeah, it was. You really enjoyed the film, didn't you?
I loved it. Absolutely loved it. One of the other companies that worked on the film was Frameworks, also in London, and you had the opportunity to talk to a couple people there.
Yeah, what we thought we'd do now is break down one shot and have a look at it. And the one we chose was one that Frameworks did, which was the Nut Room shot. If you remember in this sequence in the film, a little girl goes at getting one of her own squirrels, and the squirrels attack her. And this actually ended up being, as you'll hear, involving a lot of digital squirrels and digital squirrel replacements with the fur and stuff and all the motion. It was a very complicated shot.
Let's go to that now.
First, we go to Andrew Chapman in London. Andrew was actually involved in designing the fur and the grooming tools that were used by the guys to do the squirrels. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Hey. Great, thanks.
Where are you speaking to us from right now?
At home in my flat in London, so it's a bit earlier in the morning than I'm normally up, but going to work today.
I'm sorry to wake you, but thanks very much for joining us. Look, we wanted to discuss really one particular aspect of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which was the section that you're involved in, which was the squirrels and that sequence. You must have been very happy with the way that came out.
Yeah, I think the whole team is pretty happy with the result, and even from all the general film reviews and industry stuff, it's been getting a pretty good response. So, we're pretty happy. And normally you do a bunch of work and there's some good shots and some bad shots, but I think it's been quite consistent with this batch of work, and we're pretty proud of it.
Well, let's walk through that if we can. Obviously, the film itself has been very successful. That sequence is quite often a favourite amongst people. I know that it was here. So you've got, let me get the set of ask you to give us the setup. The idea is that the squirrels are checking nuts, and I guess in a perfect world they wanted to do that to be 100% real.
Yeah, obviously in the last version that they filmed, they left that sequence out because kind of impractical to do entirely for real, and they didn't have the whole CG thing at that point. This time around, Tim Burton was keen to give it a go and do that sequence. I think I've read somewhere that that's one of his favourite things from the book, but anyway, lots of people have said that, and they were disappointed that it was left out of the last version. This time around, CG's an available option, and it's all possible, and as much as they could, they were trying to do it with the real squirrels, but obviously there's a limit to what real squirrels can do, and they're not going to be able to carry a little girl across the room, so we had to step in there.
So they really weren't giving you much slack, were they? Because you're basically intercutting CG squirrels in the final edit with live action, and I mean, there's really nowhere to hide on making them look, and move for that matter, in a believable way.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you look at the overall sequence, there's a few very close-up shots that you can obviously pick as the real squirrels. There's some later shots where the real ones have been cut in. I think at the point where they're all jumping up on her, they're almost all CG now, but there may still be some real ones in there from the plate. It's hard for us to even pick in some of those points. Once they're all moving, though, it's a different ball game. If they're kind of sat still in front of camera, it's a difficult thing for us to get that absolutely photoreal. But once there's a little bit of movement in there and the sort of animation talent goes in as well as the look development stuff, then I think they hold up really well.
So let's break it down for people that don't know. How big was the crew and how many shots were you doing?
There was 130 shots, I think. About 60-odd were CG squirrels. So the remainder of the shots were a lot of 2D work and some other short sequences like Grandpa Joe, where he sticks his tongue out and there's a chocolate bird. But I guess from my point of view, at least, the bulk of our work was the CG squirrels. And 64 shots of those, and we actually had a remarkably small crew. So there was about 6 TDs, 6 animators, 5 compositors, and obviously supervisors and lots of support people on top of that. But that's quite a small crew. If you say to somebody that you're going to do 64 shots of 130 creatures with 6 TDs, that's a pretty tall order. So I'm quite happy that we managed to pull it off with a small crew.
So can you walk me through exactly what the pipeline was from a technical point of view? Firstly, did you capture a lot of data on set in terms of the lighting?
It wasn't such an important issue, really, because I'll kind of leave it for the other Andrew to talk to you more about lighting, but it was a very uniform lighting environment, being on set and kind of a round room. So capturing the lighting wasn't such an issue. Obviously, there was lots of work going into lighting them and making them look real, but from an actual capture point of view, that wasn't such a problem. I guess, did you want to talk about the pipeline in terms of animation and rendering? Or?
Yeah, actually, let's start with how much sort of lead time did you get to R&D the fur? Was it something that you came to once you'd come off set, or was it more like you knew you had to do them from the outset, so you got a lot of time to perfect the squirrel fur?
Yeah, had a bit of a lead up time to work that stuff out before they started filming. I think possibly about 6 months worth before we really needed to start showing to production that we a real looking squirrel. I think starting in about June of last year, we began looking at the fur issue. And so we had a few options at our disposal. There was an existing fur system at Framestore, and obviously a few off-the-shelf options, including shave and a haircut and Maya fur. And so we began looking at all those and sort of seeing how we can push them. And I think any those options would have done the trick for a single squirrel. But when you're talking about up to 100 in a shot, anyone that's done fur stuff realizes that a furry creature starts to kill your machine, starts to, you know, really be up against what you can do. And so when you're talking about dozens or up to 100, you really need to look at the problem in a completely different way. And so it became apparent quite quickly that we needed to write ourselves a new fur system with that in mind right from the start, sort of trying to make it as efficient as possible at every step in order to get right through to the render with all those creatures in there. So, yeah, I think you'd say about 6 months of development time of mostly myself and a couple of guys helping out. So Chris Lawrence was quite helpful, and, yeah, a few other people helping out. But kind of from a TD's point of view rather than a pure R&D development point of view, about 6 months work.
And so how did you really go about solving it? Because in some respects, looking at the pictures, it almost looks like there's a couple of different types of fur. I mean, there are hairs that are longer, and there's different properties of the fur on the one squirrel.
Yeah, I think it broke down to 7 fur layers in the end. So you possibly could have got away with one fur description and then being very careful about painting maps for different areas and different sort of randomization parameters, but it becomes a lot easier and you can break it down a lot better by treating each different patch of fur as a separate bit of fur. So, for example, the tail, sort of long, feathery, fluffy sort of fur description, and the face is very, very short hair. There were two separate fur descriptions on the body, so this sort of longer and short and curly, and the belly is like a white fur, and separate fur on the feet, and so yeah, just break it down into little patches of fur, and you can treat each one separately. And in fact, carrying that right through to the composite process, even though we're rendering a single image, we still had ID channels to break out each separate part of fur, so the compositors could grade those up and down as they needed.
So what was the pipeline? You were working in Maya, is that right, as the base?
Yeah, so everything starts off in Maya, being the squirrel modelled by Matt Hughes in Maya, and all the animation work being done in Maya as well. And we had an animation pipeline whereby the animators could sit there animating a single high-res squirrel, and at the point where they were kind of happy with it, they could push it into a lower-res rig and just keep adding more and more squirrels. And so those guys would bake out to an animation library, and the TDs later on would bring in the animation to their scenes, light them, apply the fur, and render. And I guess we'll get onto that in a minute, but even at the render stage, it wasn't reading things directly out of Maya, it was still referencing that original animation library to keep things a bit more efficient.
What was the renderer?
So everything's rendering out to RenderMan, so Pixar's PR man, and I think that's kind of the only way you'd really get that volume of fur rendered, and even so, you're really pushing it the whole time. We found up front that you can only feed PR man in the order of 10 or 15 million hairs before it really starts to bog down, and we had in the end 5 million hairs per squirrel, and so that's just not possible if you just sort of take a naive approach and throw it all at PR man and expect it to sort it out. It's an incredibly efficient renderer, but that's just far too much data for anybody to handle, so had to sort of cheat and make things a bit more efficient in the pipeline.
So what were some of those cheats? Can you tell us how you sort of solved the problems?
Yep. So without going into too much detail and giving away the secret sauce, it's kind of... you'd be amazed what you can get away with not putting in the render and still sort of having it apparent in the end. So the greatest efficiency gain is through level of detail. So a foreground full-res squirrel might have 5 million hairs in it. But if you pull it away from camera just a little bit, you find you can use half that many hairs and it will still look just as good. So we had a level of detail parameter. So if you set the level of detail to 0.5, it would use half as many hairs, and each hair would be twice as thick. And so if you get that, if you're setting that level of detail parameter not too aggressively as things go away, you can get by with just a fraction. So some of the shots where the squirrels are just sitting on their stools in the distance at the beginning of the sequence, I think they're using about 5% of their final hair count in the end.
Wow.
And, yeah, they look fine. And, in fact, it's a little bit counterintuitive, but if you use less hair, you actually get more visual detail at a distance because the hairs get chunkier, and so you get, you just get more detail, whereas if you use all the hairs at a distance, they kind of just filter and blur together, and then you end up looking like a more solid surface. So that's one trick. And the other things were just the having the fur system generate things in a lazy way. So instead of generating all your fur up front and passing it all on, you give PR Man lots of hints about where the fur is, and then you tell it to sort of call you back later when it's really, really sure that it needs that. And so as it's rendering, sort of going down the screen, rendering bucket after bucket, it was actually generating the fur as it goes and then throwing it away after that little tile is rendered. And so according to PR Man, it's only rendering a tiny little bit of fur at any given moment. But by the end of the frame, it's churned through gigabytes and gigabytes of fur data.
So what sort of render farm did you have? What sort of render times? How responsive was it when the TDs were trying to nail that look and lighting?
A really important thing in getting a look right is to keep your iterations quick. So if you're sitting on a 6 or 8 hour render, there's no way you're going to get a dozen iterations at going through and getting that lighting really perfect. So it's quite important to be able to have the options to dial it down and just get a quick result. So if you're taking your initial setup, lighting passes at getting the look right, you could turn that level of detail down and just have maybe one or two squirrels in there. And in that situation, render times on the render farm using just a couple of procs together through net rendering, you might get a preview frame back just in a matter of minutes. But the final frames, some of the render times were going horrific for certain frames. So it could be up to sort of 20 hours a frame for certain shots. But I think on average it would be a couple of hours per frame.
One question I had about the render quality, was it the case that if you tried rendering lower res, in other words, like a 1K or a lower res proxy, that wasn't giving you an adequate understanding of what the fur would look like at 2K? Or was it possible to render, you said you could drop squirrels from a shot, but could you also do a lower res frame, or would that really not give you an accurate idea of what the fur was going to look like?
When they're close up, I think you can kind of get away with that. That's all right. Obviously, you're not getting all the detail in there, but it'll give you your overall lighting, and then you might go up to a 1K or 2K towards the end just to check the detail and the spec hits and things like that. At a distance, though, it becomes an issue. If you render something smaller and it's already only 100 pixels high, then you're going to instantly be losing things like the specular hits and that are really going to contribute when you render back at full res again. But certainly for getting most of your preview passes until it's almost ready, you can always work at a lower proxy res, sure.
And tell me, were you doing this as like a floating point pipe out of 3D? In other words, what were you handing on to the compositors? You mentioned already that you're doing mats for each of the different furs. What would a typical shot, in terms of the layers, what would you give the compositor?
Okay, so everything we're rendering out is OpenEXR, so that instantly gives them a lot more flexibility. And also, we're pretty heavy on the generating lots of passes side of things. So I think on this we're looking at about 20 passes. I'm not exactly sure. It was about that number. Obviously, you've got your beauty, which is as close to the 3D operator can get to a perfect image. And then your basic sort of standard lighting passes, so key light, specular, etc. So there's probably about 4 or 5 passes there that the compositor could produce or reproduce that original beauty image just with those few passes, and then obviously they've got a bit more flexibility. And then the remainder of the passes are sort of little utility and mat passes, so being able to separate out each individual bit of fur and depth passes to camera, height passes off the floor. It's just surprising how quickly these little utility passes can add up, you know. You think you've got everything and you give it to the compositors, and then they'll ask, oh, I need to be able to separate out this little thing. And you think, oh, yeah, we haven't thought of that yet, and you add one more. And so that number can go up pretty quickly, and you have to sort of rationalize it back down again. But PR Man's pretty good at being able to handle them. You can, through a single render, you can produce an arbitrary number of these output images, and they don't really add that much extra render time. So if they're going to give the compositors that bit more flexibility, then, yeah, it's always worth doing.
So it obviously worked out pretty well, because I believe the production spent, I mean, I don't want to dish the on-set guys, but apparently there were animatronic squirrels that weren't actually used because your stuff worked out so well.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure whether they might have made it into one or two shots, just when they're kind of on the edges of frame or in the distance or something. The animatronics might have still made it in there. But yeah, it's a bit of a constant frustration for us CG guys to see the amount of effort and money that gets spent on practical things on set. And it makes perfect sense. If you're the director or the DOP, you want to actually see something in front of the lens. You don't want to trust it all to the geeks to put in there later on. So on one hand, it kind of makes perfect sense for them to attempt to do it practically like that. But yeah, for us to see all the money being spent and for things to not be used or to be discarded later on, or to find that you're trying to match an animatronic, you're lowering your result to try and match an animatronic sometime is quite frustrating. But
do they give you an animatronic one to have in the office to muck around with?
No. We certainly had sort of a squirrel skeleton as reference and things like that, and we went out on set to see the real squirrels, no, we didn't have any real or animatronic squirrels in the office.
So looking forward, what sort of tools, I mean, not talking specifically on this production, but generally speaking, what sort of tools and what sort of directions do you see things either needing to develop or being able to be developed in?
Specifically for fur and creatures, you mean?
Exactly, yeah. For fur and creatures, was it problems that you felt like you needed more in any one area, be it direction or, I guess, brushing of the fur, as it were? Or was it more the lighting quality of the fur or just render times? Is there anything that strikes you moving forward?
Yeah, I think with the tools that we had, it's possible to produce, a single photoreal furry creature, to the nth degree. You really are always limited by how much time you've got. The thing that we found was limiting us in terms of operator time and patience was grooming the fur, and which is a little bit of a manual process at the moment. So it's not as manual a process as producing it on a real maquette or something where you've got your hair gun and you're placing hair after hair. So obviously you just lay down guide curves and paint maps and such to describe the fur, and it interpolates all the ones in between. But you're still sitting there sort of tweaking guide hair by guide hair, and we're sort of wishing for some higher level tools to do the grooming. So if you could imagine sort of sitting there with a model in your hand and a comb in your other hand, it'd be quite intuitive to be able to literally brush the hair and have it respond. And we're not quite at that level yet. It would have been great if we had another couple of months or an extra set of hands to write some of those tools. So in the end, we were kind of pulling CVs around guide hair by guide hair, which is a bit of a frustrating experience in the end. Obviously gives you the right result, but it takes a bit longer. A bit more time, and we would have had some of those tools.
Well, look, thanks for walking us through that. I really hope you either get a squirrel spin-off film or a chipmunks live action that lets you develop some of those things. But I think the work is great. I think you're quite modest in saying that you can pick it, because I think that it stands up very well at the cinema. I mean, extremely well. So thank you very much for walking us through that.
Thank you for having me. Cheers.
Next up on our podcast is another member of the Frameworks London team, and that's Andrew Whitehurst, who is responsible for the shading, texture, and lighting on the squirrels in the Nut Room sequence. Right, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. Andrew Chapman, as you just heard, worked on producing the shaders and some of the grooming tools, and it was Andrew that had to actually light the squirrels to make them look beautiful and fit in with the shots, and he joins us now also on the line from London. So, Andrew, thanks for joining us and getting up early in London. Where are you talking to us from?
Well, I'm talking from home. I'm currently taking a bit of a sabbatical away from professional visual effects to get my head straight. So I've been working very hard for a few years and thinking about getting back into the saddle.
Brilliant. So we'd like to discuss your work on lighting in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And in particular, we're focusing on the breakdown of the squirrels in the Nut Room, which was a great sequence. You must have been very pleased with that. I mean, it looked terrific on screen.
Yeah, I think we were all really pleased. It was an awesome team that we worked with, quite a small team as well. And it was great because we had a whole group of individuals, each with very specific skills, that really pulled together well. And I think you can see the results of that on screen. And when we started, as with most projects, you have no idea whether you're actually going to be able to do what you're supposed to be able to do. And yeah, there's a few dodgy moments along the way where you're thinking, oh, is this actually going to work? Can we do this? And you know, by the end, we were pretty happy with everything that we'd done, I think.
Yeah, and I think it was good. So let's discuss squirrels. In particular, how you go about lighting actors that aren't there, especially the ones that are only sort of 8 inches tall. I guess even before that, what trouble there was in actually identifying the generic squirrel that is in everyone's mind, you know, the perfect squirrel. Was it hard coming to the perfect squirrel?
That I think was our biggest not mistake, but the thing that we had not really taken into account before we started. We certainly thought that developing a fur system would be tricky, and grooming the beast would be hard because they've got lots of very different qualities of fur all over the surface. But I suppose along with everybody else, you just have this mental image of what a squirrel looks like. But when you actually study lots of squirrels, and we took lots of really good high-resolution digital pictures of the real squirrels that were being trained, it became very obvious that every squirrel is a total individual, particularly facially, and that there is no such thing as a generic squirrel. I mean, same thing as there's no such thing as a generic human being. They are that different. And then when you're trying to say, okay, well, we quite like the cheek fur off this squirrel and the fur around the eyes off this squirrel, and this squirrel's got a really cute nose, and we like the ears on this one. When you actually try and sort of bolt that together into some sort of Franken squirrel, it often doesn't really work. And it took an awfully long time to actually come up with something that we liked, and it's a problem that's compounded by the fact that you have to model the underlying geometry and then stick the latest version of the fur that you put on top of that, look at that and go, okay, well, we don't like that. Is it that we don't like the fur on that, or is it that the underlying geometry is not quite the right shape, or is it a mixture of the two? And then so it tends to be a very, very long iterative process between the modeler, Matt Hughes, and me, who was doing the fur, and Danny Gertzman, who was doing the texturing, and me also doing some of the texturing, to actually get all of those elements working together to create one cohesive whole that worked as a creature. And once we got one done, it was comparatively easy to crank out variations on sort of the colouring of the fur and that kind of thing, and scruffiness, and some were, you know, had more of a sheen than others. But getting that first one done was much, much harder than any of us, I think, anticipated ahead of time.
When you got your Franken squirrel, and I love that expression, and you've sort of, because you had nowhere to hide with
his neck out.
You had nowhere to hide with that guy, because you were cutting with live action, and of course it was a non-characterized, you know, very real looking performance or you know, character in the film. I'm wondering about the lighting of the squirrels, because it seemed to me that there's, you know, been a lot of discussion about HDR and sampling lighting on set. And, of course, the, comparatively speaking, there's also the issues of just aesthetically achieving something that a DOP would do. How did you approach the lighting, you know, in terms of actually in a particular shot, if you want to focus like, on one shot?
Yeah. Well, the shot that immediately springs to mind is there's a shot to, right towards the end of the sequence, and the ones that I personally lit directly myself were the all the hero shots of the Skrull sat on her chest and the nut sorting ones early on in the sequence, the one where there is a Skrull basically full screen height. And if you use the actual lighting in the scene, is I went on set and I've never been in an environment that had more diffuse light than that. It was like standing inside a giant softbox, literally. And it's a very, very weird lighting quality. It looks great on skin, but it had the effect of making fur look very, very flat unless you were very careful. I think the real Skrulls tended to look okay in the environment because they were carefully graded. And also there was a fair amount of extra kick light added by the DP, I think, for those shots. And so effectively that's what we did. So we did have HDRs of the environment, which we use a little bit to sort of give us an overall kind of ambient look. But to actually make the fur have that sort of rich quality and depth to it, you have to use regular CG lights with deep shadow maps. And they are a very, very hard light source, and there's no way of making that not a hard light source because that's just the nature of the CG lighting. So the trick was to use enough CG light to fake the look of a soft lighting source that still actually gives you the quality of the fur, which is probably the most challenging lighting job I've ever done. I'd never lit fur before, which is also very different to lighting a regular sort of hard-edged object. And it really was exactly as you would approach it as a DP. You look at the plate, you look at, okay, well, I think there's a slight bias, say, to the left-hand side that the light is coming from, and you really want to model the creature nicely, so you don't want to use flat lighting. So I would probably over-enhance the sort of the left-hand sideness of that lighting to give the creature more shape, which also, if you've got slightly more directionality to the lighting, gives you more specular play in the fur, gives you more depth to the fur. And if you do enough of that kind of thing, the beauty will look okay. But more importantly, you actually give the compositor enough stuff in the arbitrary outs to be able to really enhance that as well.
And what about, you know, just was there any sort of rules of thumb as to, you know, how you were approaching any individual squirrel? Was it that you applied a broad lighting model and then you started going in and pinging the eyes or
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I one of the shaders which I wrote was the eye shader. And I was really aware ahead of time that I thought, because the lighting was very, very diffuse, it would be very easy to have a very accurate eye that looked dead because there'd be no kick in it. Mm. So I actually specifically designed the shader so that not only did we have independent control of the, using the map, we could boost the highlight areas so that they really pinged out, but also that we could rotate the environment map around to get it to point exactly where we wanted on the eye. So in every single shot, we've basically cheated so that the nut room is on a huge slant or something, so that you actually get the light reflection of the lights in the ceiling in the squirrel's eyes, and each eye uses a different map so that you're actually using two different slants so that each eye's got a highlight in it, which not only makes the creature look alive, but it also gives it a little bit more of a malevolent edge, which, given what the squirrels in the scene have to do, that was really important.
What proprietary software or tools did you have to develop to pull it off? You were starting in this in Maya, I presume.
Yeah, it's done in Maya, modelled in... Sorry, it's the accent thing, Maya. Maya, okay.
Yes,
modelled in Maya.
Because, you know, most of the people listening to this are American as well, and they don't understand either of us.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Okay, well, we'll be fast-forwarding through all of this then. It was modelled in... Actually, I think it was modelled in XSI. Because, Japanese likes Exasign, but most of the work was done in Maya. And for the animation, Philippe Prince wrote a piece of software called Choreographer, which enabled lots of squirrels to be animated using generic cycles for the crowd shots. And then the other huge piece of R&D was the PERS system, which Andrew Chapman and Chris Lawrence wrote, which was absolutely awesome. As a PERS system, it was brilliant because I can say this because I was the monkey that had to do all the look devs. So I was grooming the squirrel. I wrote some of the shaders and collaborated on most of the others. And texture works. I was the conduit through which everything else flowed, really. And it's fantastic actually working with someone who is developing the software as you're using it. And I can think of a really good specific example in that Chapman had put in a noise function for the length of the fur so that we could get a bit of random breakup. And it became apparent to me pretty quickly that I was going to need more than one. Now, if I was using off-the-shelf software, I'd be hosed because if there is only one noise function on the fur length, then there is only one. But like I say, Chapman, actually, look, I need two different frequencies of noise here to break it up more. And he was able to do that really quickly, get a new build of the plugin, and say within 45, 50 minutes, I had that extra element that I needed to work on the fur. And the fur plugin was split into two. One is the Maya side of it, whereby I could actually get an OpenGL preview with, say, 100,000 hairs on the creature of what I was going to get. And then the other side of it is the RenderMan procedural side that actually generated the RI curves at render time. And they both read the same data that Chapman's plugin wrote out. So really what I was creating was a series of text files that described the properties of the fur that was either read by the fur plugin in Maya or read by the RenderMan procedural at render time. But it was very, very cool being able to work with someone who was actually developing the software as I was using it, because it meant he got fast feedback on whether it was working, whether it was doing what I needed, and it meant I got new features when I needed them because of the stage of the look dev I was at.
I'm wondering, when you were doing that lighting stage, obviously there are parameters you can turn down to increase the render time. Can you just walk me through what you were trading off and what you felt you could trade off to do basically high-level feature film level fur? In, you know, could you render at a smaller frame size? Could you render less fur? Could you render less lights? Yep. What could you trade off? And then, as a result, how fast was the iterative cycle on seeing stuff back?
Well, the plugin was very smart in that if you didn't see a bit of fur, it didn't get generated. So the fur generation times were quick. The complexity really is just from PRman having to shade a hell of a lot of curves in each bucket that gets rendered. So there were various things that we could do. We could we had a level of detail control for the fur, and effectively what that did was put less fur on the beast and make each fur each fur strand wider, so that you never had a bald creature. But you had a sort of a coarser, more porcupine-y kind of looking beast. And that worked really well for testing, and also worked well for the distant squirrels, where you didn't need to have 5 million hairs if you've only got something that's...
Andrew talked to us about that. Andrew talked about how that helped a lot, especially he was surprised at how you could fall away with the, as you say, porcupining effect. But for you personally, when you're lighting a character, like what would be a typical sort of frame, and what would be the typical turnaround time? Would you be doing half res or full res with less?
Yeah, if I was testing it, I'd be doing half res, and I'd be turning some of the shading rate and the sampling down, because I'm not, if it's a little bit fuzzy, I'm not that bothered on a test frame. I'm just looking at the quality of the lighting. The other things which I was able to do is, because we had the seven different fur descriptions over the creature, if I was only working on lighting on the face, for example, I just turn off the tail and the back fur and the feet fur and the belly fur and all that kind of thing, so that was not even getting generated or rendered. There are a lot of features like that we could disable or turn down the quality settings of that meant that we could get a render through every, say, 20 minutes of the creature to check different lighting, and which I think helped me the most. nice because I was the one lighting the hero creatures. I think for the guys working on the distant shots where there's hundreds of creatures carrying Veruca or something like that, that was more of a technical issue of how do we get Randoman to deal with this number of curves per bucket, rather than aesthetic issues of, okay, well, I've moved this light around here a little bit. What does it look like? Oh, no, okay, it's a bit too toppy or a bit too roomy. Okay, I need to move that back a bit. And that kind of iterative creative process, I think I was fairly unique in being the person dealing with the kind of the beauty squirrels, if you will. And the other side of it was using the quality settings to actually get the shot through, because they were just a rendering nightmare because of the amount of geometry you were putting through the renderer.
So, to summarise, you were doing the beauty lighting of the Franken squirrels with the porcupine effect?
To test with, yeah. Although to render a full res, full quality squirrel, all the shadows turned on,
yep,
all the bells and whistles, was taking about an hour and a half a frame, which ain't bad for a creature with 5 million hairs on it.
And what about film-outing those? Were you just mainly watching that back on monitors, or did you do a number of film-out tests to get... Because I'm just really worried about the subtlety.
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, Framestore has an excellent cinema in the basement. It's in the old Columbia TriStar building, so it's very convenient for that purpose. So there are an awful lot of dailies done. Not so much when I was doing the look dev, but certainly once we were starting to work on shots, because the blue grade in the room was a very kind of specific look, and it's very easy to make squirrels go green or yellow or a whole variety of unpleasant non-squirrely colours. So there's a lot of checking on film of our progress, and also they have a whole series of film colour cube emulation software as well, so that we were getting a decent idea of what it was going to look like on film on our monitors anyway.
And I guess the killer question is, was it, you know, a case that when you first saw it projected from a normal print, it sort of married up straight away? Was it, from your point of view?
Was pretty close. There were, I think the main issues that we tended to have was with the densities of blacks, which is obviously more of a compositing issue than a 3D issue. And we've been careful when we designed the pipeline to make sure that we definitely had enough arbitrary outputs being rendered to give the compositors enough stuff to play with to fix that kind of issue.
Great. Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today. And it was really great work. And
thank you.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
Well, so now we've heard from two of the three major effects companies who worked on the film, MPC and Framestore CFC, both based in London. But Cinesite also did quite a bit of work on the film, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, they did a lot of really great model work, the exterior of the factory, as well as some interesting crowd replication work. And we cover that on the story that's online on the website at www.fxguide.com. And, look, I really think that all three companies did a terrific job. I certainly loved the film. I thought it was really, really good. And I remember it as a child. It was a great read. I mean, Tim Burton's just a really great director. Like, he just does good work. And, you know, I know that the whole mandate for this film was to make the visual effects invisible, and that, you know, it wasn't to look like an effects film. And they did do tons of stuff in camera, but in the end, there is a lot of digital work, and it's very, very good.
I thought so too. Well, thanks for listening to this week's FX podcast. Tune in next week for another edition.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2005 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.